So Obama was talking in his weekly address today about his plan to, like, he's got this, it's like a 3-year plan for creating jobs through highways and schools.
2011.
And I'm thinking, I was thinking to myself that that is probably a reasonable statement for the way a big economy moves. If he said next year you're all going to work again, it'd be lies. It'd be pure fabrication. And he's not running anymore, so he doesn't have, not that he ever did, but at this point, you know, he's in charge, so he can say specifically what he was already saying in general. Now he can say, okay, this is our specific plan. And as I said, it's not going to happen quickly, but it's going to happen. He has that way of, you know, he must be a great dad.
He must be a great dad. Man, I think he is.
It's not that we all need a dad, but at the same time, you know.
I cannot believe how amazing he is. Yeah. I liked Kennedy, but Kennedy is a shallow, two-dimensional thing compared to Obama. I can't believe Obama is.
And he's got, and the thing that keeps coming back to me and that I keep hanging on to is, aside from everything, but the specific thing that I keep looking at is his inner circle. You know, who are the people?
Yes.
Hillary for Secretary of State, was that brilliant?
Better than Vice. I kept thinking, why didn't he pick her for Vice President? Whoa, is that brilliant?
It's an interesting way to leverage all of her strengths and tone down on the competition between the two of them. Because it gives her this whole sphere to operate in on a world stage.
Exactly,
you know,
what she needs.
It absolutely appeals to her in a good way.
The world will respect us so much because they loved Bill Clinton. They know her already.
Exactly.
It is going to bring us so much more credibility. Man, I can't believe.
And I like what Bill was saying about, look, if you want to vet every speech I ever make from here to Timbuktu, just do it. Vet my past speeches, vet my future speeches. He's basically like thinking to himself, I can make up for a lifetime of fuck ups with this if I just do it right. I can really just, she can be doing this, and I can be the man because I'm going to be the man behind the power.
I'm wishing well for him.
I know his good intentions because he's a larger than life figure with the bruises and the beauties of any larger than life figure, and he just wants to do right. You know.
I hope nothing goes wrong. I so hope nothing goes wrong.
Well, you know, I mean, things will go wrong.
No, I'm talking about the big thing going wrong. Yeah. Don't say the A word.
Well, you know, that could happen, but I think it occurs to me that what may stop it from happening or make it less likely is the more people who are on board with him, because that means the more protection he gets, the more people looking out for him, the more that the kind of situation that we need to set up for him to be in that position of real vulnerability, the less likely it's to happen.
Well, he must have someone told
it's not just a matter of him being reamed by guys with guns. It's a matter of a lot of little things. Because when you look at JFK, what happened to JFK, you know, it was this whole web of things that happened for that to happen. You know, it was like there had to be a lot of people angry at him, a lot of powerful people who, you know, came together and decided this had to happen, and then a lot of little logistical things had to happen. And so it was because he'd made powerful enemies. And because he was a little bit, he hadn't really matured into his own in terms of how do you work with those who disagree with you.
Right.
And Obama seems to be thinking to himself, the way I need to not make enemies is by co-opting them. You know, by giving them some of the power, by giving them some of the authority, by getting them on my side. You know, it's like being friends with a schoolyard bully. You know, does he want Hillary Clinton out there on the rock, you know, shouting invectives for the next 8 years, or does he want her standing, you know, I mean, who would mess with him if she's standing right next by, you know, with her, you know, and her brain and just her toughness? He's going to find a way to bring more and more people on board without compromising the fact that they disagree with him on issues. I mean, he keeps saying it over and over again. We can disagree and be adults and work together.
He's so wise. He is so mature.
And that's the thing. I think he got that from his grandma. He got that from his mom. He got that from a lot of wise people growing up. He gets that from Michelle. You know, I mean, I'm sure he has male figures too, but I think that a lot of his wisdom springs from the fact that he has strong maternal and female figures in his life. You know, and I think that they guide him. They ground him, and they also allow him to really think those, you know, skybound thoughts.
We're so lucky.
So we can be hopeful. That's what I'm saying. We can be hopeful. But the thing that, what didn't happen with Clinton is something that actually Clinton and Gore gifted to Obama. We did not have the new media back then.
What do you mean the new
media? The internet and all that. We didn't have, like, Obama's messages now are on YouTube.
Yeah,
it's not just
right.
The weekly radio address goes back like 100 years or something. No, I've never listened to one on the radio because it's like Saturday morning or something on AM or something. But YouTube, you just go right there and grab it.
Right.
I play it on my radio show. It's just like,
yeah,
his words are available.
That's right.
Those who oppose him, their words would be available. You know, the whole thing is just, we can examine it day by day, bit by bit, step by step. So we dedicated this volume of stories to, this particular volume is dedicated to Victor, who
always loves a strange tale.
T-A-L-E. A very old man with enormous wings, a tale for children. And I think he uses the word children loosely. Right. On the third day of rain, they had killed so many crabs inside the house that Pelayo had to cross his drenched courtyard and throw them into the sea, because the newborn child had a temperature all night and they thought it was due to the stench. The world had been sad since Tuesday. Sea and sky were a single ash gray thing, and the sands of the beach, which on March nights glimmered like powdered light, had become a stew of mud and rotten shellfish. The light was so weak at noon that when Pelayo was coming back to the house after throwing away the crabs, it was hard for him to see what it was that was moving and groaning in the rear of the courtyard. He had to go very close to see that it was an old man, a very old man, laying face down in the mud, who, in spite of his tremendous efforts, couldn't get up, impeded by his enormous wings. Frightened by that nightmare, Pelayo ran to get Elisenda, his wife, who was putting compresses on the sick child, and he took her to the rear of the courtyard. They both looked at the fallen body with mute stupor. He was dressed like a rag picker. There were only a few faded hairs left on his bald skull and very few teeth in his mouth, and his pitiful condition of the drenched great-grandfather took away any sense of grandeur he might have had. His huge buzzard wings, dirty and half-plucked, were forever entangled in the mud. They looked at him so long and so closely that Pelayo and Elisenda very soon overcame their surprise and in the end found him familiar. They then dared to speak to him, and he answered in an incomprehensible dialect with a strong sailor's voice. That was how they skipped over the inconvenience of the wings and quite intelligently concluded that he was a lonely castaway from some foreign ship wrecked by the storm. And yet, they called in a neighbor woman who knew everything about life and death to see him, and all she needed was one look to show them their mistake. "He's an angel," she told them. "He must have been coming for the child, but the poor fellow is so old that the rain knocked him down." On the following day, everyone knew that a flesh-and-blood angel was held captive in Pelayo's house. Against the judgment of the wise neighbor woman, for whom angels in these times were the fugitive survivors of a celestial conspiracy, that they did not have the heart to club him to death. Pelayo watched over him all afternoon from the kitchen, armed with his bailiff's club, and before going to bed he dragged him out of the mud and locked him up with the hens in the wire chicken coop. In the middle of the night, when the rain stopped, Pelayo and Elisenda were still killing crabs. A short time afterward, the child woke up without a fever and with a desire to eat. They then felt magnanimous and decided to put the angel on a raft with fresh water and provisions for 3 days and leave him to his fate on the high seas. But when they went into the courtyard with the first light of dawn, they found the whole neighborhood in front of the chicken coop having fun with the angel, without the slightest reverence, tossing him things to eat through the openings in the wire as if he weren't a supernatural creature, but a circus animal. Father Gonzaga arrived before 7 o'clock, alarmed at the strange news. By that time, onlookers less frivolous than those at dawn had already arrived, and they were making all kinds of conjectures concerning the captive's future. The simplest among them thought that he should be named Mayor of the World. Others of sterner mind felt that he should be promoted to the rank of 5-star general in order to win all wars. Some visionaries hoped that he could be put to stud in order to implant the earth with a race of winged wise men who could take charge of the universe. But Father Gonzaga, before becoming a priest, had been a robust woodcutter. Standing by the wire, he reviews his catechism in an instant, and he asks them to open the door so he could take a close look at the pitiful man who looked more like a huge, decrepit hen among the fascinated chickens. He was lying in the corner drying his open wings in the sunlight among the fruit peels and the breakfast leftovers that the early risers had thrown at him. Alien to the impertinences of the world, he only lifted his antiquarian eyes and murmured something in his dialect when Father Gonzaga went into the chicken coop and said good morning to him in Latin. The parish priest had his first suspicion of an impostor when he saw that he did not understand the language of God or know how to greet his ministers. Then he noticed that, seen close up, he was much too human. He had an unbearable smell of the outdoors, and the backsides of his wings were strewn with parasites, and his mane feathers had been mistreated by terrestrial winds, and nothing about him measured up to the proud dignity of angels. Then he came out of the chicken coop, and in a brief sermon warned the curious against the risk of being ingenuous. He reminded them that the devil has a bad habit of making use of carnival tricks in order to confuse the unwary. He argued that if wings were not an essential element in determining the difference between a hawk and an airplane, they were even less so in the recognition of angels. Nevertheless, he promised to write a letter to his bishop so that the latter would write to the supreme pontiff in order to get the final verdict from the highest courts. His prudence fell on sterile hearts. The news of the captive angel spread with such rapidity that after a few hours the courtyard had the bustle of a marketplace, and they had to call in the troops with fixed bayonets to disperse the mob that was about to knock the house down. Elisenda, her spine all twisted from sweeping up so much marketplace trash, then got the idea of fencing in the yard and charging 5-cent admission to see the angel. The curious came from far away. A traveling carnival arrived with a flying acrobat who buzzed over the crowd several times, but no one paid any attention to him because his wings were not those of an angel, but, rather, those of a side rail bat. The most unfortunate invalids on earth came in search of health. A poor woman who, since childhood, had been counting her heartbeats had run out of numbers. A Portuguese man who couldn't sleep because the noise of the stars disturbed him. A sleepwalker who got up at night to undo things he had done while awake, and many others with less serious ailments. In the midst of that shipwrecked disorder that made the earth tremble, Peleo and Elisenda were happy with fatigue, for in less than a week they had crammed their rooms with money, and a line of pilgrims waiting their turn to enter still reached beyond the horizon. The angel was the only one who took no part in his own act. He spent his time trying to get comfortable in his borrowed nest, befuddled by the hellish heat of the oil lamps and the sacramental candles that had been placed along the wire. At first, they tried to make him eat some mothballs, which, according to the wisdom of the wise neighbor woman, were the food prescribed for angels. But he turned them down, just as he turned down the papal lunches that the penitents brought him, and they never found out whether it was because he was an angel or because he was an old man that in the end ate nothing but eggplant mush. His only supernatural virtue seemed to be patience, especially during the first days when the hens pecked at him, searching for stellar parasites that proliferated in his wings, and the cripples pulled out feathers to touch their defective parts with, and even the most merciful threw stones at him, trying to get him to rise so they could see him standing. The only time they succeeded in arousing him was when they burned his side with an iron for branding steers, for he had been motionless for so many hours that they thought he was dead. He awoke with a start, ranting in his hermetic language and with tears in his eyes, and he flapped his wings a couple times, which brought on a whirlwind of chicken dung and lunar dust and a gale of panic that did not seem to be of this world. Although many thought that that reaction had not been out of rage but of pain, from then on, they were careful not to annoy him, because the majority understood that his passivity was not that of a hero taking his ease, but that of a cataclysm in repose. Father Gonzaga held back the crowd's frivolity with formulas of maidservant inspiration while awaiting the arrival of the final judgment on the nature of their captive. But the mail from Rome showed no sense of urgency. They spent their time finding out if the prisoner had a navel, if his dialect had any connection with Aramaic, how many times he could be fit on the head of a pin, and whether he wasn't just a Norwegian with wings. Those meager letters might have come and gone until the end of time if a providential event had not put the end to the priest's tribulations. It so happened that during those days, among so many other carnival attractions, there arrived in town the traveling show of the woman who had been changed into a spider for her having disobeyed her parents. The admission to see her was not only less than the admission to see the angel, but people were permitted to ask her all manner of questions about her absurd state and to examine her up and down so that no one would ever doubt the truth of her horror. She was a frightful tarantula the size of a ram and with the head of a sad maiden. What was most heartrending, however, was not her outlandish shape, but the sincere affliction which she had been, with which she recounted the details of her misfortune. While still practically a child, she had sneaked out of her parents' house to go to a dance, and while she was coming back through the woods after having danced all night without permission, a fearful thunderclap rent the sky in two, and through that crack came the lightning bolt of brimstone that changed her into a spider. This reminded me of you. Her only nourishment came from the meatballs the charitable souls chose to toss into her mouth. A spectacle like that, full of so much human truth and with such a fearful lesson, was bound to defeat without even trying that of a haughty angel who scarcely deigned to look at mortals. Besides, the few miracles attributed to the angel showed a certain mental disorder, like the blind man who didn't recover his sight but grew 3 new teeth, or the paralytic who didn't walk but almost won the lottery, and the leper whose sores sprouted sunflowers. These consolation miracles, which were more like mocking fun, had already ruined the angel's reputation when the woman who had been changed into a spider finally crushed him completely. That was how Father Gonzaga was cured forever of his insomnia, and Paleo's courtyard went back to being as empty as during the time it had rained for 3 days and crabs had walked through the bedrooms. The owner of the house had no reason to lament. With the money they saved, they built a 2-story mansion with balconies and gardens and high netting so the crabs couldn't get in during the winter, and with iron bars on the windows so that the angels wouldn't get in. Paleo also set up a rabbit warren close to town and gave up his job as a bailiff for good, and Elisenda brought some satin pumps with high heels and many dresses of iridescent silk, the kind worn on Sunday by the most desirable women in those times. The chicken coop was the only thing that didn't receive any attention. If they washed it down with creolin and burned tears of myrrh inside of it every so often, it was not in the homage of the angel, but to drive away the dung-heap stench that still hung everywhere like a ghost and was turning the new house into an old one. At first, when the child learned to walk, they were careful that he'd not get too close to the chicken coop. But then they began to lose their fears and get used to the smell, and before the child got his second teeth, he'd gone inside the chicken coop to play, where the wires were falling apart. The angel was no less standoffish with him than with the other mortals, but he tolerated the most ingenious infamies with the patience of a dog who had no illusions. They both came down with chicken pox at the same time. The doctor who took care of the child couldn't resist the temptation to listen to the angel's heart, and he found so much whistling in the heart and so many sounds in the kidneys that it seemed impossible for him to be alive. What surprised him most, however, was the logic of his wings. They seemed so natural on that completely human organism that he couldn't understand why other men didn't have them too. When the child began school, it had been some time since the sun and the rain had caused the collapse of the chicken coop. The angel went dragging himself about here and there like a stray dying man. They would drive him out of the bedroom with a broom, and a moment later they would find him in the kitchen. He seemed to be in so many places at the same time, they grew to think that he had been duplicated, and he was reproducing himself all through the house. And the exasperated and unhinged Elisenda shouted that it was awful living in that hell full of angels. He could scarcely eat, and his antiquarian eyes had become so foggy that he went about bumping into posts. All he had left were the bare cannula of his last feathers. Pelayo threw a blanket over him and extended him the charity of letting him sleep in the shed, and only then did they notice that he had a temperature at night and was delirious with tongue twisters of an old Norwegian. That was one of the few times they became alarmed, for they thought he was going to die, and not even the wise neighbor woman had been able to tell them what to do with dead angels. And he had not only survived the worst winter, but seemed improved with the first sunny days. He removed motionless for several days in the farthest corner of the courtyard, where no one could see him, and at the beginning of December some large, stiff feathers began to grow on his wings, the feathers of a scarecrow, which looked more like another misfortune of decrepitude. He must have known the reason for those changes, for he was quite careful that no one should notice them, that no one should hear the sea chanties that he sometimes sang under the stars. One morning, Elisenda was cutting some bunches of onions for lunch, when a wind that seemed to come from the high seas blew into the kitchen. She went to the window and caught the angel in his first attempts at flight. They were so clumsy that his fingernails opened a furrow in the vegetable patch, and he was on the point of knocking the shed down with the ungainly flapping that slipped on the light and couldn't get a grip on the air. But he did manage to gain altitude. Elisenda let out a sigh of relief, for herself and for him, when she watched him pass over the last houses, holding himself up in some way with the risky flappings of a senile vulture. She kept watching him enough when she was through cutting the onions, and she kept on watching until it was no longer possible for her to see him, but because he was no longer an annoyance in her life, but an imaginary dot on the horizon of the sea.
Nice. Really nice.
That was
really well read.
Thank you.
Beautifully read. Wonderful story. Man, that man can write.
Yeah, I just love stuff because he evokes these images that are so real and so like everyday. But then it just, you know, it's like, where did this spider lady come from?
Yeah. Vital in shaping Taz reality, temporary autonomous zone reality, is the concept of psychic nomadism, or as we jokingly call it, rootless cosmopolitanism. Skip the next sentence, which is just footnotes, basically. We use the term psychic nomadism here rather than urban nomadism, nomadology, driftwork, etc., simply in order to garner all these concepts into a single loose complex to be studied in light of the coming into being of the temporary autonomous zone, the death of God, in some ways, a decentering of the entire European project, opened a multi-perspective, pulsed ideological worldview able to move rootlessly from philosophy to tribal myth, from natural science to Taoism, able to see for the first time through the eyes like some golden insects, each facet giving a view of an entirely other world. But this vision was attained at the expense of inhabiting an epoch where speed and commodity fetishism have created a tyrannical false unity which tends to blur all cultural diversity and individuality so that one place is as good as another. This paradox creates gypsies, psychic travelers driven by desire or curiosity, wanderers with shallow loyalties, in fact, disloyal to the European project, which has lost all its charm and vitality, not tied down to any particular time and place, in search of diversity and adventure. This description covers not only the X-class artists and intellectuals, but also migrant laborers, refugees, the homeless, tourists, the RV and mobile home culture, also people who travel via the net but may never leave their own rooms, or those like Thoreau who have traveled much in Concord. And finally, it includes everybody, all of us, living through our automobiles, our vacations, our TVs, books, movies, telephones, changing jobs, changing lifestyles, religions, diets, etc., etc. Psychic nomadism as a tactic, what Deleuze and Guattari metaphorically call the war machine, shifts the paradox from a passive to an active and perhaps even violent mode. God's last throes and deathbed rattles have been going on for such a long time, in the form of capitalism, fascism, and communism, for example, that there's still a lot of creative destruction to be carried out by post-Bakuninist, post-Nietzschean commandos, or Apaches, literally enemies of the old consensus. These nomads practice the razzia. They are corsairs. They are viruses.
They have both need and desire for Taz's camps of black tents under the desert stars, interzones, hidden, fortified oases along secret caravan routes, liberated bits of jungle, and badland, no-go areas, black markets, and underground bazaars. These nomads chart their courses by strange stars, which might be luminous clusters of data in cyberspace, or perhaps hallucinations. Lay down a map of the land over that. Set a map of political change over that. A map of the net, especially the counter-net, with its emphasis on clandestine information flow and logistics. And finally, overall, the one-to-one map of the creative imagination, aesthetics, and values. The resulting grid comes to life, animated by unexpected eddies and surges of energy, coagulations of light, secret tunnels, surprises.
And so Rachel Carson has always been very important to me. And so Mother See the Great Beginnings is what we published, and it's an excerpt from her second book, which was called The Sea Around Us, which was published in 1951. It was the second in a trilogy about the sea, which she wrote before Silent Spring, which is, of course, what she is most famous for. And so I'm just going to read a couple of excerpts. I'm starting on the bottom of page 10. For the past 500 million years, the rocks have preserved the fossil record. By the dawn of the Cambrian period, when the history of living things was first inscribed on rock pages, life in the sea had progressed so far that all the main groups of backboneless or invertebrate animals had been developed. But there were no animals with backbones, no insects or spiders, and still no plant or animal had been evolved that was capable of venturing into the forbidding land. So for more than three-fourths of geologic time, the continents were desolate and uninhabited, while the sea prepared the life that was later to invade them and make them habitable. Meanwhile, with violent tremblings of the earth and with the fire and smoke of roaring volcanoes, mountains rose and wore away, glaciers moved to and fro over the earth, and the sea crept over the continents and again receded. It was not until Silurian time, some 350 million years ago, that the first pioneer of land life crept out on the shore. It was an arthropod, one of the great tribe that later produced crabs and lobsters and insects. It must have been something like a modern scorpion, but unlike some of its descendants, it never wholly severed the ties that united it to the sea. It lived a strange life, half terrestrial, half aquatic, something like that of the ghost crabs that speed along the beaches today, now and then dashing into the surf to moisten their gills. Fish, tapered of body and stream-molded by the press of running waters, were evolving in Silurian rivers. In times of drought and the drying pools and lagoons, the shortage of oxygen forced them to develop swim bladders for the storage of air. One form that possessed an air-breathing lung was able to survive the dry periods by burying itself in mud, leaving a passage to the surface through which it breathed. It is very doubtful that the animals alone would have succeeded in colonizing the land, for only the plants had the power to bring about the first amelioration of its harsh conditions. They helped make soil of the crumbling rocks, they held back the soil from the rains that would have swept it away, and little by little, they softened and subdued the bare rock, the lifeless desert. We know very little about the first land plants, but they must have been very closely related to some of the larger seaweeds that had learned to live in the coastal shallows. Developing strengthened stems and grasping root-like hold fast to resist the drag and pull of the waves. Perhaps it was in some coastal lowlands periodically drained and flooded that some such plants found it possible to survive, though separated from the sea. This also seems to have taken place in the Silurian period. So I'm going to skip to page 12, because this is one of my favorite parts, and I think this is why we both chose this chapter. On land and sea, the stream of life poured on. New forms evolved. Some old ones declined and disappeared. On land, the mosses and the ferns and the sea plants developed. The reptiles for a time dominated the earth, gigantic, grotesque, and terrifying. Birds learned to live and move in the ocean of air. The first small mammals lurked inconspicuously in hidden crannies of the earth as though in fear of the reptiles. When they went ashore, the animals that took up land life carried with them a part of the sea in their bodies, a heritage which they passed on to their children and which even today links each land animal with its origin in the ancient sea. Fish, amphibian, and reptile, warm-blooded bird and mammal, each of us carries in our veins a salty stream in which the elements sodium, potassium, and calcium are combined in almost the same proportions as in seawater. This is our inheritance from the day, untold millions of years ago, when a remote ancestor, having progressed from one cell to the many-celled stage, first developed a circulatory system in which the fluid is merely the water of the sea. In the same way, our lime-hardened skeletons are a heritage from the calcium-rich ocean of Cambrian time. Even the protoplasm that streams within each cell of our bodies has the chemical structure impressed upon all living matter when the first simple creatures were brought forth in the ancient sea. And as life itself began in the sea, so each of us begins his individual life in a miniature ocean within his mother's womb. And in the stages of his embryonic development, repeats the steps by which his race evolved from gill-breathing inhabitants of a water world to creatures able to live on land. Some of the land animals later return to the ocean. After perhaps 50 million years of land life, a number of reptiles entered the sea about 170 million years ago in the Triassic period. They were huge and formidable creatures. Some had oar-like limbs by which they rode through the water. Some were web-footed with long serpentine necks. These grotesque monsters disappeared millions of years ago, but we remember them when we come upon a large sea turtle swimming many miles at sea, its barnacle-encrusted shell eloquent of its marine life. Much later, perhaps no more than 50 million years ago, some of the mammals, too, abandoned a life for the ocean. Their descendants are the sea lions, seals, sea elephants, and whales of today.
This is written a long time ago, actually, and it's it actually needs to be revised, but I pulled it out, and if you have suggestions, I'll take them. Anyway, it's called The Suitcase. It is set in Russia. I lived in Russia for 4 years, and it's actually based on a story that one of my Russian friends told me about her mother. It's actually a true story, fictionalized, called The Suitcase. His name was Oedipus, in Russian, Oedip. His name is Oedipus, in Russian, Oedip, pronounced Oedip, just as in French. He was as big as the table that held Tata Olga's brass samovar. Newly brushed, he was the rich, blue, black color of the oil puddles in the rutted road from the outskirts of Moscow to Tata Olga's country dacha. He was old and generally ill-tempered, though never when Tata Olga came to visit him. Tata Olga loved Oedip as much as she loved her own son, who had fled Moscow to marry a Latvian girl and never came back to see his mother. She loved Oedip far more than she loved any of her neighbors, except, of course, her best friend Baba Sveta. At times, she felt that she loved Oedip even more than Baba Sveta. His owner loved him. For, as the years wore on, Baba Sveta talked less of Oedip and more of her grandchildren. Six of them, four of whom crocheted coin purses for her at the Palace of Young Pioneers and carved sturdy wooden figures of ponies that they brought to her on Sundays. Oedip, a great black dog of no known breed, was strong and sure and noble in his youth, and noble and dignified in his old age. He lived with Baba Sveta in the flat across the landing from Tata Olga's. Tata Olga visited him almost every day and brought him table scraps. As she conversed with Baba Sveta over a steaming cup of black Georgian tea with jam, Tata Olga's eyes met Oedip's eyes in long looks of mutual understanding. When the time came for Baba Sveta to make the journey east to visit her grandchildren, the two who did not come on Sundays with coin purses and carvings of ponies, she turned, of course, to her neighbor and best friend, Tata Olga, with her request. With sincere pleasure, Tata Olga agreed to take care of Oedip during the weeks that Baba Sveta would be gone to faraway Omsk, beyond the Urals. It was not much trouble. Tata Olga had only to feed Oedip and take him out for his walk in the morning and in the evening. Often she would stay at her friend's flat with Oedip for an hour or two at the end of the day, just to keep him company and to talk to him of her cares. Then, without warning, on a rare sunny May day, Oedip died. Nothing happened. He didn't even seem sick. Before supper, Tata Olga went to feed him and found him lying there on a worn spot in the kitchen linoleum, as if asleep. He was very peaceful, but dead. Tata Olga didn't know what to do. She couldn't reach Baba Sviata, who wouldn't return for a long time still. She felt very sad for her friend, and guilty too, because after all, she had promised to care for Adib. And she had no idea what to do with a dead dog. At first, she tried to ask the authorities. But alas, in Russia, seldom is anything accomplished by asking the authorities. She placed a dozen calls, and then a dozen more. But always the telephone was busy, or no one answered. Or if they did answer, they couldn't tell her where to take the poor dog to be, as Tata Olga delicately phrased it, taken care of properly. She talked to her friends, the few she could confide in. It was a problem none of them had encountered before, a problem their sound socialist upbringing had not prepared them to solve. At last, Tata Olga made up her mind simply to bury the dog herself. There wasn't much time to think about it. The cold winter had passed, so Adib wasn't going to wait long. There was no place near Tata Olga's apartment building to bury him. A public park certainly wouldn't do. At last, she decided to take Adib to her dacha outside of Moscow, out beyond the rutted road with its puddles of oil, to bury him there in her garden. To get to the dacha was a long trip. First, the walk to the bus stop, and the bus to the metro, then two metro trains with a change between them at Bieloruski station, then the long ride on the Elektrichesky out of Moscow to the countryside, and finally another bus. For the journey, Tata Olga wrapped Adib's body in a patched white and blue tablecloth and put it in an old suitcase. It was heavy. She could carry it only with great difficulty. She had to stop frequently to rest, but, well, Tata Olga was very determined. She was also very clever, Tata Olga. By the time she stepped off the bus near the metro station, dragging the big suitcase behind her, she knew she would tire long before she reached her dacha garden. Her arms ached from the weight of Adib. She stopped one more time to rest and to think. And then she became a bit of an actress. Approaching the entrance to the metro, Tata Olga smoothed back the white hair beneath her kerchief, lifted her bent shoulders, and played the coquette just a little. Her eyes grew clear, and for a moment a bloom passed over her withered cheeks. Soon a strong young man in a leather coat offered to carry her suitcase. He lifted it onto the metro train for her and rode with her and carried the heavy thing through all the long tunnels at Bieloruski station where they changed trains. Then it happened. After they boarded the next metro train, just before the doors closed, the man who was helping her jumped off and back onto the platform, taking the suitcase with him. It was not unexpected. Everyone knew how dishonest young people had become since the passing of the old ways. Tata Olga raised a big fuss right there in the middle of the crowded metro car, but there was nothing to be done. Her neighbors on the train clucked and nodded and agreed with her that young men like that are just no good. Thieves are everywhere, people muttered, even in the nicest of neighborhoods. It's the mafia and the Democrats, and those swarthy intruders from the Caucasus who are to blame, they said. At the next stop, Tata Olga, holding her chin high, got off and turned around to go back home. She smiled, rather pleased with herself all the way. The hard part came when Adib's owner, Baba Sviata, returned from her trip. Tata Olga had to tell her about the big dog's death, how she found him lying so peacefully on the worn linoleum of the kitchen floor with no sign that anything was wrong. And then she had to explain about the suitcase and the journey to the dacha that never came to pass because of the young man who ran off with the suitcase. Baba Sfiata shed tears into her teacup, but fortunately she understood. Of course, she was sorry Adip was gone, without even a proper burial at that. She loved him, but he was very old, and it was his time. In a few months, she went to the bird market and got a new puppy, for the grandchildren, she said. Like Tata Olga, she had a corner in her heart just for animals. Tata Olga and Baba Sfiata talked for a long time over their Georgian tea about the wicked young man in the leather coat, how he must have felt when he finally got home and opened that heavy suitcase. Even the suitcase was old and not much good, chuckled Tata Olga. Just imagine the look on his face. The two old women agreed. Young men are all fools at heart. One sidelong look from beneath lowered lashes, and they'll leap to carry even the shabbiest, heaviest suitcase. Yes, a lady must always know when to play the coquette.
That's delightful. So that was a true story?
Yes,
on a true story?
It was based on a true story. That actually happened to a friend of mine's mother who had to take a dog in a suitcase on the metro to the dacha to be buried, and she did exactly that.
Dead end. I ask where from. No, ask again, whither on. No worse, ask why the best of many centuries but ghosts and books, their lights and lives offered in mere tales of songs of endurance, beggaring to be remembered. I ask, has anything changed but the slaves' names and the kinds of toil? I ask, lastly, if the dust blowing past is for burial or new spark. When nothing else. I know I share with you that hour when you two were abandoned. Somewhere a nod, a phone call, a reason or two enough. You walk through streets too, beneath stars, quiet despairing. The answer not now or ever to come why. Time passed, new fruit grew, but always now that tinge of something, that linger, that slim fissure of sad. Tell it in words tonight tells nothing. What you know and the less for it, what I know and struggle around. Something else too, this nod between us, this empathy we could brew like a tea, this breathing, this endurance, this crack between hearts. This one's called Endurance. Dust, a violent hour, endurance. Crack between hearts, a silence like a burial in breath. Tonight trembles sweetly to one touch, salts blindly in others' eyes. Violent hour, dust, endurance. Tonight wreck the remaining bones of a belief, of a love. Wreck what green rides old cracks high. Endurance, violent hour, dust. What rises with the light, what crosses the moon, what sings shores empty of men tonight. A wish, a riddle, a truth. I have been trying to work with something, a phrase called imaginal space. I think of it as, you know how we were talking about Burning Man and the, what do you say, the porn stars who go there and they work the space erotically, but they work it in an artistic way, like a shaping of the space in using their materials, their ways toward interesting ends. That's really fascinating. And I see the world as imaginal space. One night, Cassie and I were walking down 21st, and we stopped and looked around at everything, and it seemed like there was just a super abundance beyond what was rational to what was around us, in terms of habitation, looking at restaurants, you know, looking at bars, looking, there just seemed to be a, like, this was not mereness. It wasn't what was minimally needed. This was shaping, literal shaping of the world. And just, you know, just these regular buildings and restaurants, not you know, we weren't looking at the pharaoh, the Sphinx, I mean. We weren't looking at something, you know, grand and revered for artistic qualities. We were just looking at ordinary buildings and restaurants. But nonetheless, the world is shaped. We shape it. It seems self-evident, simplistic, and yet I've been trying to think, well, what does that mean? Because you often get from mystics and even from physicists, you get this thing that you create your own reality, and if you go down to the subatomic level, things are all banging around and nothing's really solid, and like, what do you do with any of that stuff? And I think the bad commercial end of what you do with that stuff is you package it into books, self-help books that delude people into thinking that there are easy answers to life.
I mean, those don't work.
Just for you, Victor. But the harder answer is that when someone says you create your own reality, I think, yeah, but what about the next guy? I've got to deal with his reality too. Like, it doesn't diminish the physicist's or the mystic's statement, you create your own reality, you create your own world, but, you know, the next guy, the guy sitting next to you is looking at Hustler. You know, that's what he's looking at Hustler, and this guy over here is, you know, he's watching Fox News. And then this guy over here, he's reading, you know, Eschler, whatever, Goodell and Bach, you know. So, imaginal space is just the idea that the world is literally the materials that we use to create it. And I don't really know what to do with it. I don't even know how to articulate it well. But it's been just this phrase that I've been thinking, well, it's good to work with. Maybe it's just because I like words. So, what?
For a long time.
What?
Imaginal space.
Yeah.
That sounds nicer to me because you are the complete craftsman of that, because I think in the both the physicists and the mystic sense, we are constrained by the world's reaction to us. We have this gravity, we have this atmosphere, we have this kind of conscious mind that has created these kind of questions and say, I create my own reality.
Yeah.
And that's where we are. But if you say imaginary space, then you really are, all the other stuff dissipates.
Yeah.
You have a much freer time to create whatever you want, magical realism.
Oh.
Then you can choose what physics work, what physics do not work.
Yeah.
Are there angels? And what is an angel?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's more fertile ground for inspiration, I think.
It's come into a special... Did I come up with a Wikipedia entry that's right there? Oh, it's not there? Oh, good, cool. Excellent.
Coin it.
Yeah. Copyright it. Sell it. Blog it.
If anybody infringes on your copyright, be sure to sue.
Give me a nickel.
It's weird. That is very weird.
Bill Gates presents Imaginal Space Windows.
Ding dong. It's become especially poignant to me because I'm now jobless and I have to figure out a way to work with the world in terms of getting a job, but I'd like to do it in some way that both acknowledges the world as it is, but is not necessarily limited by the way it is at this moment. I mean, I don't want to act out of desperateness. I want to act, maybe it's the Obama effect in my head, but it's like, I want to act coolly.
You want to be a hunter in your own forest.
Basically, if you learn how to write reasonably well, you can write a reasonably good poem about something that means something to you emotionally, or something that you feel passionately about. But to conceive of and to work with more abstract ideas, you essentially move a lot in metaphor. But if you move too much in metaphor, then you really don't have any, you just have everything like everything else. You don't have any actual ground you're working on. So that's kind of been the challenge with any of this stuff. That said, imaginal space. What rises with the light crosses the moon. What sings shores empty of men tonight? A wish, a riddle, a sooth. A moving space, a movable space. Call it imaginal space. One music, many musics, the poorest ground to any staying cry of human truth. Tonight wreck the remaining bones of any belief, any love, any fire not fed by the hour. Wreck what green rides, old cracks high, what oncomes a torrent, violent hours, endurance, dust. The dreams their caterwaul, but who would listen? Call it imaginal space, the shifting crack between hearts, a wish, a riddle, sooth. One music, many musics. Ask what tool is this? Say what needed, a salve, a meal, knowing the tongue of the galaxies themselves. The challenge is to see tonight's glowing door by the morrow's plain light. See and step through. I think because I was having so much fun that night, I decided to write Imaginal Space 2.
Ooh, the sequel.
Toward the morrow's plain light, the bursts of darkness along its hours, the finely strummed gestures rent by a fumbled faith in mystery, a trip back into the junk of common truths. Common truths able to brick up a wall or score a small rift of power. Common truths, bursts of darkness. When laces shred, behold an easy wet cunt or a lightning to ride through. And then, because I was having so much fun philosophizing, my next poem is a very different turn, called Long Exhaust. If I had, because I loved you, because you possessed, if I had the night crackling with your crimson scent, if the year a leaden one for men, even as youth burnt, every youth burned high, nearer, nearer, the mystery of that room he slept in, plush and posters and icons to denial. Now hush as I do, and sweet that you are, another room of voices as we, but call this my hour. Hush, no denial, hush, no lost years, hush, youth most like the gods of men, for a moment, our hearts crack, and time itself burns. So here's really what I wanted to get to. This is, those were the working up poems, but these are the ones that I really wanted to get to. And I had written all those poems in one night. So this was the last. This is the fourth of the bunch that I'm reading. Tonight's questions: Why electrify an animal with consciousness? Why point his eyes toward the stars as he shits? Why make fucking the stuff of grunt and prayer? Why let him speak knowing in lies and truths? Why the rift from nature, urge to know, consume? Why the dread path to demise with dreams of escape? Okay.
I like that one.
Yeah. Tonight I decided to answer it.
Wow.
Yeah. Cool. I decided to put myself to it. I had 2 hours, I had some Spangle, I was pretty fucking high. It's like, all right. Ask me a bunch of fucking questions. See what I can do. Come up with the answers. So, each of these six poems is an answer to a question. Maybe I'll go back and forth. So the first one, why electrify an animal consciousness? And the response is electrify. Offer the elixir you drink, and now the stars familiar and the trees shaman. Her body living starlight to the touch, and the furthest dreams upon this petal. This petal, this moment, this forever moment, and the music consumes you. The water she feeds you crackles with knowing, the grass's friend, the drums every heart's glad yearning tongue. Come morning, the daylight of get and shove, the hole in hours burned by coins, and explained by some men as penance, as test, as deferred promise for someday's great golden land of light. Come morning and you wonder, what is it for? Should I have drunk? Come morning, something's missing, important. It was there, last night, in her crystalline smile, in the moment when you forgave all, knew all was well, breathed, relaxed. Missing. Missing? You've drunk the elixir. You are awake now. Walk the earth, sober or laughing, till you find it, or were wrong, and let go. Why point his eyes toward the stars as he shits? The stars while shitting. In desert, the far-blowing desolation hearts know. Squat in plastic box, thumping sounds of immolation and ecstasies without. I sat with a puzzling book and read its first lines. Suffer, it said. This is why you suffer. This canker of want in you, each of you. Name it a god or devil. This is why you suffer. That you live from first cry, riven, and crawl your years to be whole. That you cry up love into myth to keep it a step away. That you litigate desire for its blind, brutal wish. Build great towers and temples of distraction. Cage your every last soul in discontent, in bitterest hunger. This is why you suffer. My shit came sudden and raw, and the plastic ceiling above my head exploded. The stars fell in on me. I was a moment so beautiful and dead. Yes, this is why we suffer, for the shattering moment when nothing makes sense and we nod. What? Yeah, I was reading the Bible really high at Burning Man. And I was just like, what the fuck is this shit? I had a Gideon Bible. And I just somehow ended up in a porta potty with it, really, you know, tripping and just, oh my God, fuck. That Garden of Eden, that like the opening chapter, that's what I was reading. And I was just like, oh my God. I was like running away the rest of the night. So I don't really know. I mean, that's just, I was just starting somewhere, you know, stars and shitting. Okay. Why make fucking the stuff of grunt and prayer? Grunt and prayer. I moved inside her a little deeper, a little harder. She grunted, liked it hard, liked it to hurt. Yes, hurt. Oh, make it hurt. Hurt me. Make me forget. Love me. Consume me. Crush my tits. Harder. Deeper. Consume me. I want it. Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I withdrew a little. Young. What had I loosed? What demons risen here? This darkened small room. The dinner half eaten on the table. The moonlight radiant and mad through the single window above the brick wall. What demons... I pull back and she breathes hard. Who are you? Just fuck me. Who are you? Just fuck me. 10, 20 years dissolves, 30, 40 one day soon, and I still wonder, who was she that night? Which she do I mean? Which night? Breathe heavy remembering. Breathe sad. I want it. I want it too. Why let him speak knowing in lies and truths? Lies and truths. The last time on phone, my father was lost to space and time, raving in hospital bed, waving his legless stumps around while nurses murmured and checked numbers. He cried into the phone how we'd fight them together, the bastards, the enemies, the ones keeping us far, the ones who had not told him this is how it would end, this drowning, this ravaging despair, this freak tempest of professional eyes, this humiliation, this taking and taking and taking. I think of him now, bones in the earth, free of time and pain and all he loved. Were his life's truths any softness beneath those last hours? The truths, the loves, the promises vowed to someday. I wonder, and I wish I could have given him a warm hand on his cheek, a word of comfort. Everything is all right, and this is a lie, and this is truth. Why the dread path to demise with dreams of escape? Oh, I'm sorry. Why the riff from nature urged to know consume? Sorry. Riff from nature. There were moments, maybe three, maybe fewer, when I uncoiled back to root, into soil, into sunshine, exhaled, and again, the world we are drinking each other, the world we lay in wordless song dreaming at night, the world... The wings inside my ribs, the web between my toes, uncoiled through clouds when I rained, fruit I was eaten and shit seed back to earth, moments when the stars too were like fruit, hanging impossibly from endless skies. And what was left of me danced and died, and what I was, and what I possessed, and what made the world, and no reason why. Finally, why the dread path to demise with dreams of escape? Dread path. Tonight's hungers are new and old. Every face wears them and looks to another to explain. Cities crackle by the sparkling crowds pushing, shouting into taverns, and those awaiting a last hour, and those fearing a familiar voice in its knowing hand. Tonight's hunger range canyon and jungle, green sea and white woods, and some fill bellies, and some fuck whatever sweet they may. Tonight's hungers left us by a combustible god or molecule or alien star parent. Tonight the taverns ever more crowded, the rhythm beastier, the clothes tighter, the words exchanged more plain. Tonight's hungers draw us nearer the end by weapon, by evolution, by the return of whoever led us down here, seeming bid to wonder and wait, or by obscure thought hurling heart shadows that nothing's to wait for, everything's to be done. We are the tinder that waits gathering and ignition. But you know, what's interesting about what he's doing is that, and I don't know if he'd think of it this way, but if you bring disparate people together and allow them to keep their disparate opinions, but to get them all at the table and to find where the common ground is and to sort of like pull it strand by strand out until you have something that collectively represents your differences as well as your agreements. That's psychedelic space. I don't know how that helps me get a job, but I'm telling you, tonight, in this setting, this whatever environment that we've raised up with our spirits, that is psychedelic space. You bring disparate elements together, and you make something new. You don't have the enemy and ally thing. You totally do away with that. He's like, this guy's the rabid anti-abortionist. Bring him along. Okay, what do we do about it? No. I agree with you. Christ, blah, 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 blah. But what do we do about it? How do we legislate it so that it works? How do we mold it? And then you have the other guy over here and you bring him in. And it's like, that's fucking psychedelic. That's what we're, in my opinion, what we're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, that's the next
we're not supposed to be... like all agreeing on everything in terms of anything. I don't think we're meant to be one. I think we're meant to be many that work together, that leverage our differences. I think that's what he does. He leverages differences of opinion because he sees that there's value in those differences. And there's often too much emphasis on we're all one. But our lives don't teach us that. They teach us when there's a bunch of people at the street corner and the light turns green and someone crosses first and here comes a car and he gets hit and he's down on the ground and the rest of us, because we didn't take that first step, we're watching and he's on the ground. That's what life teaches us over and over and over again, that we're told we're one, but we're not. We're mortal bodies. Each of us deals with the fact of that mortal body, that person's dream life, that person's history, that person's intellectual understandings and how much they can do with, mental cogitation, whatever. And so to somehow be told that you have to merge with everybody else, on some level, it feels wrong. I mean, it's something you can actually articulate, but just this idea that you have to merge with everyone else, it disputes. It takes away from you something that you don't want to take away, and yet there's this thing you want to give. So you're like, okay, I'm at the table. I want to be me, but I want to be at the table. You know, like a family, where they're all sitting around the table, they're all having a meal, but they all have different opinions on the day's matters. And I think that's Obama's driving for: get everybody around the same table, but not pretend that you don't have the rabid anti-gay rights guy and you don't have the flaming gay guy. And it's like, but that's amazing. And I really think that there's something to be said that's rooted in something. It's rooted in some kind of thinking that goes way beyond modern political governance. And that's what I admire about him, because I don't know how deep his thinking goes about this, but I think it does go fairly deep. I would like to know the sources of, like, where he's coming from. He seems like a person that has places he's coming from, you know what I'm saying? Like, thinkers and experiences that have brought him to where he's at.